pattern of the stars as its guide, just as the ancients navigated from the pole star. So ancient man, morally and ethically, navigated his Argo, or his Argonaut, his great expedition on the ship of salvation. According to the map of the heavens, he had to keep the laws of heaven. He had to follow the stars of heaven. And he had to follow in faith. And he had to withstand the tempest of circumstances with a greatness of spirit, or he could not succeed. Much of this is beautifully concealed in the part of the fifth book of Virgil's Aeneid, where we have a further description of the initiation ritual. So we will assume that after all these thousands of years, man still must walk the strange, star-spangled road of the zodiac. He does not walk it in the sky, but as he walks it through a series of qualitative experiences in himself. So we will begin now with the sign of Aries, the ram. We've already indicated the religious significance and the great institutions of the mysteries that were created around these signs, so we will not consider them at the moment. Now, when we do think religiously of the ram, however, we think of the Lamb of God, we think of the scapegoat of Israel, we think of the offering of the ram of Ammon. We have many various meanings. The seven-horned ram of Revelation stands out, and the ancient ram's horn, which blew the covenant, we also remember, and the ram's horn trumpet of Hindo, which called to the last great war in the Nordic mysteries. This ram's horn cup, in which the Eucharist of the ancient Gothic rites was celebrated. All these tell us interesting things and remind us of the universality of symbolism. Actually, the great key, it seems to me, of Aries from the standpoint of the moral virtues of man is courage. Courage, which belonged to the planet Mars in the previous cycle, belongs also to Aries, which is the essential dignity of Mars. It is where Mars is peculiarly enthroned. So courage is the beginning of the journey. Without courage, nothing can be achieved. Ulysses has to start forth in courage. Hercules had to have courage. The seeker after truth must have courage. Now, what is the root of courage in man? What gives man courage? It's hope, imagination, dreams, convictions, or perhaps even more than these things, the great path of his people. The way of the good and the brave who have gone before. Courage is steeped in tradition. Courage comes from the authority of sacred writings. Courage comes from the inspired words of divine teachers. But man must have courage. The courage to do, to dare, to go on. So out of courage he must build and fashion his first instrument. And yet with courage he has other problems, because Aries also signifies combativeness. And here combativeness must be eliminated, because combativeness will lead to war, will lead to stress, will lead to ultimate perpetuation of the sowing of the dragon's teeth. So man must have courage without aggression. He must have strength without ambition. He must have dedication without despotism. He must have the ability to rise above obstacle without the inevitable tendency to enslave or destroy the rights of others. So the delicate test of courage rests with him. How to be strong yet kind. How to be brave yet simple. How to be great yet humble. All these mysteries play out in the conduct of human life, in which we must gradually identify this mysterious symbol of the competitive and combative animal with the Lamb of God, the symbol of purity and of truth. Thus, the animal of fire, the animal of war, the ram, also becomes the symbol of the Prince of Peace. And this is our victory, which has to be achieved within our own consciousness and experience. We must have the courage without the combativeness. We must have the dedication without the ruthlessness to carry it over the bodies of the dead. And so man must achieve without destroying. He must attain without injuring. He must solve the mystery without bringing disaster upon any other living thing. Thus becomes the test, the mysterious problem which he has to solve. And when he has solved it, assuming that he does, or at least that he has solved it as far as he can at any given moment, then he passes on to the second sign of Taurus, the bull. And under the symbol of Taurus, he has that peculiar power of steadfastness. Now, steadfastness is the indomitable determination of purpose. But how can we have this steadfastness without other less favorable aspects appearing in connection with it? How can we be steadfast and not stubborn? That is the trick. The ancient developed a great philosophy on the individual who could remain true to himself without being untrue to somebody else. The individual who was capable of being serenely purposeful and at the same time not be locked, not be closed, not be held by some false attitude in his own mind. Very much of the loyalty that we think about is only stubbornness. Dedication is not what it always seems to be. It is just habit. It is the individual doing it because he has always done it, and not because it is right. So under the sign of the bull comes this mysterious power, this tremendous power of this creature, the power to go on, to persevere. For like the plodding ox that draws the plow through the ancient muddy waters of the Nile bank, like the same stolid ox that is on the rich man's table, like the ancient Nandi, the bull that rides Shiva upon its back, the bull of heaven and the bull of earth, and the bull which Virgil says opens the egg of the year with its horns. This bull of continued determination must be analyzed morally, spiritually, into motive and into every conceivable understanding that we can bestow upon it. We must fight and solve the mystery of the Minotaur within its labyrinth. For this was the bull-headed man. Sometimes we say that people are bull-headed, and we are not referring to the Minotaur in most cases when we say that. We are referring to an objectionable stubbornness. And yet in the midst of this symbol of the labyrinth, in the ancient Greek legend, the labyrinth of Crete, the labyrinth of the ancient temple, palace, here we have the world with all its strange and torturous passageways and chambers ruled over by the bull-headed symbol of stubbornness, arrogance. Look around you. Everybody knows he's right, and everything goes wrong. We can get an ear for very little. Everyone is determined to protect his own interests. Everyone has closed his mind to that which differs from him. And each smugly entrenched behind his own defenses is concerned primarily with the security of himself and his group, and with old prejudices and unchangeable crystallized attitudes, we seek desperately to prevent the growth of tomorrow or the survival of today. This is the Minotaur ruling the world. It is reaction. It is the old stubborn pride. It is the individual who must fight with his own fear of change, with his own determination to be loyal to his opinions rather than to truth. And the hero must fight that fight. And it's a great fight, and everyone doesn't win immediately. Now the third sign that the soul is confronted with is Geminis, the twins. And here we come into a very intriguing problem. The problem of psychological polarity. Here we come into one of the strange things that is most obvious in the human mind. The more stupid a person is, the more certain he is. The more thoughtful he becomes, the more uncertain he becomes. And you take the comparatively thoughtful individual and you say, I want a yes or no answer. You'll have a very hard time getting it. You will get the famous political answer. Yes, and then again, no. The individual will say, it would seem this way, but perhaps it is the other way. Why? Because we pass through a period in which, as someone said, we become broad-minded but a little flat-headed at the same time. We mistake uncertainty for generosity. We like to think we're liberal, but the fact is we do not have the answer. And because thoughtfulness gives caution, we have lost directive in a great many instances. So everything in life is polarized. And we have the various Aristotelian techniques of either and or. We have the individual who, departing from the evil, would cling to the good, but has already established a polarity that has destroyed truth. We have persons seeking the soul against the not soul, only to discover tomorrow that they were wrong on both counts. We have the individual who tries to judge fairly, but fails because he does not know the facts involved on either side. We also find the individual who tries to help, but fails to help because he does not really know what is helpful. And wherever he would be helpful, he is capable of harm. The polarities go back and forth. So this side of Gemini represents mental division within the individual. Mental division leads to disillusionment, skepticism, cynicism. Mental division also leads to weakness, and it leads to the elevation of the functions of the mind above the purposes of the mind. We develop the thinker for the sake of thinking and not for the sake of the thought. We develop the individual who writes beautiful words but never means anything. We hear or see the grammarian who can construct a sentence perfectly, but the sentence never contains anything that will change the course of history. It is skillful but not purposeful. So this division, by separating and destroying the penetrating power of intensity, leaves the individual upon the twin horns of the Gemini dilemma. He is unable to determine anything, or he is locked in the polarized conflict of things. One of the good examples of that is the American Civil War, where we have the War of the Brothers. In ancient England, Lilly said that the United States was under the sign of Gemini, the twins. And we had the War of the Brothers, It is now nearly a century since that war, and yet we're still fighting it. And we're still struggling over it. And we're still trying to figure who was right and who was wrong. And we have a great many people who do not care who was right or who was wrong. They're on the other side, whichever it may be. We cannot let it die. So Gemini gives us another thing. It gives us this division, it intensifies prejudice, and then it never lets anything die. It keeps on fighting the war after everybody's dead. It keeps on winning the argument after everyone else has gone home. And it keeps on trying to figure out how it could have won the argument for days after it has lost the argument. Division. All this seems perhaps a little on the flighty side, but underneath it, there's a principle here. This principle of duality, which caused Pythagoras to spit upon the ground whenever the number two was mentioned, simply because it represented division. Wherever there is division, there is loss. That which the gods would destroy, they first divide. And wherever there is division, then there is need for reconciliation. And this process of reconciliation is itself a strangely subtle form of hypocrisy. Nothing seems to work out. Because actually, we are dealing with things substantially indivisible. Their unity must be acknowledged, not achieved by human defense. It is there to begin with. And we cannot defend it, we must discover it. There is a very peculiar problem, which we have to go on to very carefully. Then we pass to the next type, where we gain the mysterious heritage of the moon. And the moon gives us the strange inheritance of moods. The moon gives us light and darkness. It gives us this strange inconstancy within ourselves. It caused Paul to cry out in his agony, "When I would do good, evil is ever nigh unto me." It causes the individual this strange weakness in his own nature, making him a servant of tides, making him moved upon surfaces which he cannot control, like a ship in a storm. And this strange moodiness of man, the mood of greatness and the mood of failure, the inability of the individual to depend upon himself, the inability of the individual to rise above the pressures of his own passing moods. So the hero must master his own moods. He must master the inconstancies by which one day he is for and another day he is against. He must pass beyond those moods which weaken him in time of need. Moods which mean that his total resource is not available to him at any time. So the moon tells us that everything ebbs and flows, that everything seems to have beginning and end, and that everything is upon the sea of life, subject to generation and degeneration. Life and death, birth and decay, these things moving in strange cycles. And in man, these cycles infinitely repeating themselves, so that with every phase of the moon, man hopes or fears by pressures which he cannot understand. Thus man, fighting the moon, fighting this struggle within himself, is fighting the inconstancy of himself. Fighting the insecurity in which he cannot depend upon his own nature to stand behind him. He must bring his own nature into line. He must conquer the shifting rays of the moon's phases. He must gain the ability to keep his light even when the moon becomes dark. So the moon has always been the symbol of the lesser light. It has been the symbol of man's hope, dream, faith, one moment strong and another weak, increasing, waxing, waning. And here man seeking constancy, seeking mastery over the excess of his moods, so that he shall do no thing too much nor too little, watching himself against the pressure which forces his idealism into vanity, forces his dedication into fanaticism, forces his determination to serve into hypocrisy simply by pressure. Because pressure can cause an individual to say the end justifies the means. The moment he has done so, the madness of the moon is upon him. Now after this situation, he meets the next struggle in which he must overcome the lion and perhaps clothe himself in its skin. Yet in the ancient legends, he must slay the lion without a weapon. He must slay it with his bare hands, and he does so by breaking its jaw. This is the story of Hercules, and also the story of Samson. Now the lion is the home of the sun. It is the sign of energy. And to overcome or conquer the lion and clothe oneself in its skin is to overcome pride, overcome power, overcome force in its every aspect. For there is scarcely a moment in our days when we are not tempted to do something a little more strenuously than the ethics will permit. We have the feeling that with a little more force we can accomplish our end. We can overwhelm our adversary. We can sell that merchandise which he does not want. We can force. We can use energy, not for our own advantage, but for the disadvantage of someone else. And the moment energy transcends its natural usefulness, it becomes like gunpowder. Gunpowder may help to blast a dead stump out of a farmer's field, but it has also laid the world waste with war. Atomic energy may give us new sources of light and power and warmth, motion, but it can also wreck us. So that power within the individual, if harnessed to conscience, if bound to consciousness, as in the ancient fable of the young maiden binding the lion's jaws with her handkerchief, an ancient figure found sometimes on tarot cards, if gentleness can hold the power of the lion and the unicorn, we then understand something that is very important to us. Namely, that nothing that is good shall ever be attained by force. The moment you use force, the force becomes evil. Yet it is life without force, energy without pressure, action without aggression. These are the secrets that the ancients tried to tell us must be conquered and mastered and understood by the soul as it walks along the yellow road, offering itself as a gift to heaven. And we go on to the sign of the Virgin. And here we come to one of the most ancient symbols in the old zodiac system. And we find it curiously associated with one great keyword out of antiquity. The conquest or the mystery of the Virgin, the capture of the girdle of the Amazon, has to do with the mystery of service. The crest of the Prince of Wales in England is taken from the ancient German, ich bin, I serve. These were the last words of Kundry as she fell dead at the foot of the Grail. I serve. Service becomes one of the great problems of the labor. And to achieve service, one must understand the mystery of the World Virgin. For service is actually bringing forth into life. That is the meaning of service. When we serve, we bring something forth into life. When we serve the need of our friend, we help to bring that friend forth out of darkness into light. All service is releasing life. In the ancient agricultural content or context, the virgin carries the sheaf of grain, because if man serves the earth, it brings forth the harvest. Service, therefore, is making ready the way. It is perhaps sounded in the words of John the Baptizer, "Prepare ye the way of the Lord." For service is to prepare the way of life. Service is to prepare the way for those who do live. Service for the young is preparing them for life, preparing them to bring forth. Service of the strong, if we help a man in trouble, it is in order that we can assist him to bring forth out of himself those resources which are his true solution and which we cannot convey to him. Therefore, service requires great discretion. Service requires a wisdom almost beyond this world. But the symbol of service for the Virgin is the great question: what must we do in order to do good? And to answer that question requires practically all the wisdom of the ages. For usually our help is of a sentimental nature. We are kind, we are sympathetic, we do something. And because we do not know what we are doing or why we are doing it, we then sometimes come to a keen disappointment, for the person neither appreciates nor understands, and our good intention is imposed upon or exploited. It is because our good intention was not wise with the wisdom of the server. We do not know how to serve. So to struggle with the problem of how to help another and at the same time not hurt him, for that is the rule, we must never hurt, reminds us again that the only way that we can serve another person truly, perhaps, is to help him to do those things which are nearest to his own soul. Try to find out what his need is and then help him do what he wants to do rather than what we want him to do. Otherwise, our service goes immediately into dogma and into despotism. But the problem of service, of sharing without hurting, of giving without impoverishing, those are the secrets of the mystery of the maiden with the sheaf of grain. And the next time we stop in the great zodiacal circle, we stand in the presence of the balance of Libra, the pair of scales tipped strangely and held by a strong angel with a blazing sword. And here man seeks the problem of equilibrium. For justice is always balance. Justice arises from fairness. Fairness arises not from a man's ability to see the two sides of a situation, because there are usually more than two sides. Justice consists in recognizing the law as it applies to all sides. Thus, Pythagoras pointed out that virtue is not upon one end of the pan, one pan of the balance, and vice upon the other, and we do not weigh the living and the dead. Vice is at both ends, and balance or truth is in the center. And it is only the scale that balances that is true, and the only true part of the scale is the balance in the center. So man, searching always for survival, for truth, seeks equilibrium within his own consciousness, realizing that the moment he polarizes or unbalances, he will be unlawful. So to bring all extremes to moderation gives him justice. For justice is moderation. Justice is in no thing excess or privation. Justice is in all things truth, victorious over all error. Thus there may be 50 errors about a matter, but only one truth. And justice is to discover that truth. Man, surrounded by many factors in living, must seek always the balance, must seek always the truth that underlies all these different contending, dissenting parts. He can never know them all. He can never understand them all. He can never recognize them all. Therefore, he remains true only to the balance, keeping the equilibrium, and in all matters, clinging to the law. For the law is his hope and his salvation. So by Liber he is taught that in all matters he must first of all be true to principle. And if he is true to principle, all other things will balance out. And he passes from there to the ancient sign of the scorpion, sometimes represented as a serpent and again as an eagle, the only sign which has three distinct glyphs of its own. Now they said in ancient times that the scorpion was the symbol of death. But in the old mysteries, the sign of the scorpion and the sign of Scorpio, the night house of Mars, the nocturnal entrance to the underworld, was always guarded by the god Hippocrates. Not Hippocrates, Hippocrates, the god of silence. And he was always represented standing or seated at the front of the temple in this position, with one finger on his lips. He was the god of silence. So the sign of Scorpio in the old mystery rituals taught us the secret of silence, the most valuable noise that there is. Silence is a strange, deep darkness. But silence, while it may seem to be the mother of mysteries, is exactly and actually the firstborn of truth. For in silence and silence alone, all mysteries are solved. All soundings end in silence, and from silence came all sound. A man, in his search for reality, must not only have courage, have skill, and have understanding, but he must also have the power to be silent. For if to speak is silver, as the German proverb used to say, to be silent is golden. And this golden silence is not merely not speaking. It is a silence of quietude within consciousness. It is this actual problem of being still that we may know the mystery of the divine presence. So the sign of Scorpio has always been peculiarly associated with the mystery rituals. All rituals had to do with death. All symbolical transformations were represented by the mortuary ritual. The initiate passing into the underworld in the ritual went through the mystery of death, presumably, symbolically. For he descended, as the rite says, into the great silence. He descended into the aloneness, into the abyss of darkness. And here he must not be afraid. So silence is the gateway to internal life. And for every person who can speak wisely, there is a greater wisdom for those who can simply listen. Strangely, the power to listen is greater than the power to speak. And who listens learns. Who speaks knows only about himself. Thus in the ancient rites, the search for silence was the ability of the person to remain eternally receptive and observant, always able to accept, and never interrupting God with his own voice. For in the mysteries, to speak is to interrupt God, but God is the infinite truth abiding in the silence. And when our speaking gets too loud, we cannot hear the voice of the infinite. So to be quiet, to be receptive, to conquer sound in our own souls, to seek silence, this is to pass this mystery of the scorpion. who becomes transformed into the serpent of wisdom and into the eagle phoenix of inspiration. Now, the ancient sign of Sagittarius was the old sign of aspiration, but it represented the old centaur, who was the teacher of Archides. It was therefore the representative of nature. It was representative of the universe. The centaur is the universe as man's instructor. Therefore, out of the many levels and powers of the natural process come the instructions which are to serve man, and the great instructions are religion, philosophy, and science. And the centaur represents these, because he is born out of the threefold mystery of the universe, part human, part animal, and aiming his shaft at the stars. So in this particular mystery, in the search of the soul for reality, the centaur represents instruction. Now, instruction is a strange word. What shall a man learn? How shall he learn? How shall he know when he has learned? The ability to receive instruction, said Socrates, is first of all the ability to accept reproof. The individual is hypersensitive to any criticism of his own thinking, who is unable to change his own attitudes, who considers it more important to remain the same than to accept guidance, has not learned the mystery of instruction. For instruction, as Emerson points out, is the inevitable consequence of the enlightened human being's contact with nature, whether it be human nature or universal nature. From every other human being we can learn something. For this human being may be only of our own kind, the animal body of the centaur. But yet there is not a person who lives that does not know something that we ought to know. In the same way, we can learn from every branch of knowledge, not only its immediate instruction, but its great message, the message about universals. And we can see that all knowledge flows from the great fountains of universal consciousness, and that sky and earth and air are forever teaching, that the sunrise and the sunset are our instructors, and that everything that happens as a message, adversity, sorrow, problem, responsibility, these are the teachings of the centaur. For the centaur is life and nature, teaching us to become heroes. And some will reject the teacher because the body is that of a horse. Others will say that the teacher itself is only an imperfect creature rising out of its own darkness. But nature is that. Nature is a god with the body of a horse. And nature is the teacher. And it is teaching us both human ways and divine ways. It is teaching us both the mysteries of our animal existence and of our universal state. To be receptive and to recognize instruction, and to see the universal teacher in the simplest of our friends, or perhaps in our own children, is to be able to know instruction. And beyond the sign of instruction lies the ancient symbol of Capricornus, the sea goat, dedicated to the two cities of Babylon and Nineveh, one upon the top of a mountain and the other by the shores of the sea, part fish, part goat, and the infinite symbol of man's eternal prudence. For in all things, man must be prudent. He must be forever mindful of the dangers of excess. And he must realize that even a virtue overworked becomes a vice. He must search for temperance, which makes prudence natural and reasonable. The prudent individual is the one who neither overestimates nor underestimates, thinking that neither that he is stronger than nor weaker than himself. So prudence has about it self-analysis. And the sea goat tells us the story of man's prudence, guarding the higher and lower parts of himself, derived partly from the sign of the mountain and partly from the sign of the valley. The sea goat becomes the symbol of extremes, which must be bound by prudence. Man must not ascend too high, nor must he fall too low. For when someone asked Aesop what was the work of the gods, he said, "The labor of the gods is that they are forever raising up the humble and are forever casting down the great." And this is the problem of prudence. Man must never rise too high. Man must never fall too low. And whatever direction he seems to extend, he must forever search again to control the consequences of excess. Coming back to prudence. Prudence which causes him to grow no more rapidly than he can. One of the commonest problems of imprudence in growth is the person who, overestimating his own attainments, rushes forward and takes upon himself responsibilities and duties too much for his knowledge, and then finds reverse or tragedy. Never overestimate yourself. Never underestimate your adversary. Never overestimate what you know or underestimate what you do not know. But remaining fair and honorable and prudent in all things, use what you know and improve yourself in what you do not know. And you will find a great security, a great integrity, which will enable you to live with yourself without doubt. For if you are reasonable and prudent, you have faith in the judgment of yourself. You know that you are careful, that you are thoughtful, that you are rational in your procedures. Now the 11th sign is a water bearer, carrying upon his shoulders the canoptic jar from which pours a strange stream of electrical energy. And the symbol that this carries to the truth seeker in his effort to grow is the eternal recognition that it is the desire of the truth seeker to build better worlds and better ways for others. Therefore, this sign is curiously connected with aspiration. An aspiration is a strange quicksand. Again, man must fight the ores of illusion, for wherever there is a virtue, there is an illusion twisted around it. And as Zelophus Levy, the great French transcendentalist, said, "In the beautiful pastures of the astral light, every blossom has a poison serpent twisted around the stem. And when you pick the flower, you are bitten by the serpent." Now, aspiration is like that. We all desire to build a better world. We desire to create this golden age we look for. We seek utopias, but we know why they have failed. We seek to bestow upon others vision which they cannot receive. We demand from others understanding which they cannot give. We find a world unsatisfactory, so we declare war against it and do nothing. We reject society because we do not endorse it. And if it fails to live up to our standard of what it should be, we curse it in our hearts. Forever, behind the thin veneer of altruism, we fall into criticism, condemnation, and strangely subtle destructiveness. And nearly all of our so-called aspiring souls have been antisocial,
because they have never really understood the world they were trying to help. They have never recognized that we are all working with children. We are working with good children and not bad adults. We are working with those who cannot know more than they do. And we must build our dreams of a better world upon realities, upon things as they are, recognizing that progress is a series of slow and gentle steps, and that if we take one step wisely, we lift the world further than when we race ahead and then beckon it to follow. It cannot follow. So aspiration must be geared to abilities, our own and the abilities of others. If we aspire too greatly, we cannot live up to it ourselves, and our conscience hurts us. When we claim virtues that we cannot apply, we injure ourselves. So our claims should be more modest, and we should always aspire to the next thing, moving one step and realizing that the great journey of life is a trip which is made up entirely of single steps. When we so understand, we are then able to bear all things with that virtue which comes under the mystery of the fishes. For in ancient times, the fish was sometimes called the symbol of the poet. And the poet, of course, is always the one who buries an empire. He is the one who writes the funeral odes to the glories of all other things. But the poet also becomes the symbol, in this case, of patience, a virtue man has much trouble with, and also of humility, which is easy if we are patient. But patience, humility, and the poesy of high verse belong to this side, for its purpose, its real reason for existence, is that it teaches man the mystery of enduring. For in the sign of the fishes comes the deluge that wipes away all things, but beyond the deluge there comes a new heaven and a new earth. So the sign of the fishes is always waiting for the resurrection. It is that which, having planted the seed of the earth, must wait patiently for God who doeth the works. So in this sign, man learns that there are things which he can do and there are things which he cannot do, and that it is right and proper for man to labor, but the works must be crowned with the life of the universe. Man without the universe can do nothing. Man cannot hasten the gods, nor can he retard them. He can prepare their ways, but he must await their works. So patience means that man can no longer be disillusioned, no longer defeated. No longer can he die of a broken heart because things are not imminently successful. Patience gives perspective. It gives great time. It is the hope of the long visioned. It is the only answer to the great things that must be done. For these things must be fulfilled in the fullness of their own time, and not according to the hopes and ambitions of mortals. So patience and humility complete the signs where the road began with courage, and all courage ends in patience, and all strength must end in humility. And then the great cycle begins again, for humility reveals the courage and gives birth again to the beginning of things. For from patience comes a strange kind of courage that is not of this world. So the ancients said, man walking the golden road had to learn these mysteries, and we have to learn them today just the same. And out of learning them, we keep the great pattern of the road that leads upward around the stars and into space. And this road is going to continue to lead, And men may conquer space. They may go out and travel to other planets and other stars. But they can never get beyond the mysterious, invisible road for which the stars stand, where all conquest must fail. All discovery must come to naught, unless conquest is the conquest of self, and discovery is the discovery of that which is locked within the innermost and the furthermost of existence. Thus the astronomy and the philosophy and the religion of these peoples formed one pattern. And I think there is sufficient utility in that pattern to make it worth our remembering. And also there is something quaintly delightful in these mythological burdens and the intricate chess games of emotions and attitudes to which they bear witness. Our ancient friends were very astute in their understanding of human psychology. We can profit by the fable if we can apply it to ourselves. And by so doing, we will understand man's journey around the great mystery of the golden road that leads back home. And I think that that more or less summarizes the concept of the ancient astrotheological philosophy. And we thank you very much.